You're listening to the Flying Goat Farm podcast with your host, Lisa Check. This podcast is for people who love yarn and fiber and sheep, who love to knit and crochet and maybe even felt. We will be talking about the crossroads between keeping sheep and goats, making yarn, and expressing your colorful self. Hey everybody, it's been a while, hasn't it, since I've had a podcast, and I'm really excited about season five. Season five is going to be all about natural dyeing, and at the end of each episode, I'm going to highlight one of my favorite natural dyes and also some more in-depth information about our farm yarns, because everybody has asked for that information, and so you asked for it, and I'm letting you have it. But before we get there, here's what's happening on the farm. I'm recording this mid-March, and it has been such a weird winter. We never got any appreciable snow, but we've gotten some flurries, and we had, I think, like the warmest December and January ever recorded in this part of the world. My plum trees are in full bloom, most of them, not all of them. I have a couple of late bloomers. My apricots are the earliest ones, and they are just about done blooming. All the hopefully we got some pollination. This year we do have bees that are alive and viable, which we haven't had in the last couple years because of the weird winters. And so I'm hoping that we get some lovely apricots. We've had those trees now, I want to say 10 years, maybe longer, maybe 12 years. And we've only had 1 year, count them, 1 year where we've had any apricots, because they flower early, and usually around this time, and it still could possibly happen, even into early April, we have gotten a serious cold snap, and if any of the fruit has started, it falls to the ground and dies off. Or as you know, the last couple years we didn't have significant pollinators around, but now we do. So I'm hoping, because those little apricots were so good the last time. It's like, you know, I have this in my, you know, it's like a historical, like, voila, we had this wonderful apricots that we could eat that were so flavorful and made the best jam. And I would really like to do that again. So we're hoping that that happens. So now on to natural dyeing. So what is the big deal? So, you know, natural dyeing, and the word natural itself has been bandied about a lot in food and in textiles and, you know, everything, the carpet that we walk on and all of that. In dyeing, the word natural specifically means that the dyes are coming from sources that are found in nature. So they're coming from plants, all the different parts of the plants. They're coming from mushrooms and lichens. They may be coming from mud or earth pigments. And some of them even come from animals, like my favorite dye that I'm going to be talking about today. It comes from an animal. And this is the oldest dyeing practice in the world. No doubt it started with observations that, you know, certain things made color on the skin or on clothing that was worn at the time. And from those observations and curiosity, the practice was codified and made, made solidified in the history of the dyers and the cultures where they were practicing the certain dyes. Recipes for colors were, and they still are, collected and guarded by families of dyers. In the book True Colors, there is a story of a family in Central America that has, it's all memorized, nothing is written down, but they have this amazing library in their family culture of all these colors that they can make from the plants that are in their particular ecosystem, in their habitat. And so, yes, these colors are very local, and they come from dye sources that are in the immediate vicinity of the dyers. And at a certain time, there was bartering and trading, which I'll talk about in a minute, so that there could be, you know, if you wanted that purple that was from the shellfish in the Mediterranean, you bartered for that. But that was down the line. And let me be clear, natural dyeing is not like acid dyeing that we do on wool or on fiber reactive dyeing that we do on cottons and silks. Natural dyeing is more of an art than a science. There's some science to it, yes. There, you know, it is all chemically based, but it really is an art form. You can use the same materials on a different day and get a totally different color. So it's a lot more of a conversation between the dyer and the pot and how to develop the pot and all of that. It's really fascinating. So most of the early dyes were foraged, and many really are still foraged today, such as the walnut hulls, or tree bark, or tree leaves, or wildflowers, lichens that you would find on trees or rocks, mushrooms from the forest, and things that we would call weeds, like, you know, dandelions, goldenrod, things like that. They, again, these are going to be local to the dyer if you're going to be going out and foraging. And we always ask people to be a responsible forager, specifically when you're talking about some of the more rare dyes, which would be like the lichens and the mushrooms. You want to be sure that you're not taking the whole organism so that it will come back the next year and continue to thrive. And many dye plants can be successfully cultivated around the world and even in our own gardens, like indigo, madder, marigolds, sunflowers, lots of different zinnias, hollyhocks, lots of different flowers give color. And these can be grown in your own garden. And then as the practice of natural dyeing increased, there became some bartering, like I was saying, and trading, and that continues today. So you can buy responsibly foraged and or grown dye stuffs that are fair trade. And it's a way to buy exotic dyes that only grow in tropical areas that you wouldn't be getting to, or only grown in dye stuffs that may be endangered. So there's certain areas and certain communities that have a license to responsibly use some of that for dye. And so some of those dyes would be logwood or sapinwood or Himalayan rhubarb and indigo. And traditionally, these are foraged and processed into a concentrate or an extract in a community and then purchased by companies here in the United States or Canada and then resold to us at a fair trade price. And with natural dyeing, water really matters. And this was an eye-opening thing for me several years ago. I was dyeing with my favorite dye, Coach Anil, that we're going to talk about. And no matter what I did, I could only get kind of a light lavender color. And I just couldn't understand it. And what it had to do with was the condition of my water. Many of the natural dyes are sensitive to alkalinity or acidity in the water. So you can shift the color one way or another way by adding vinegar or adding soda ash or some other alkaline substrate. Also, many water sources will contain iron or other minerals, or even if you're living in the city, it may you may have chlorine in your water, and those things can shift the dye color too. Now, the dyer can use that water, knowing that the colors will shift from the expected colors that you would expect, or the dyer can then collect rainwater, which I've done, or use distilled water, which is pricey. I wouldn't suggest that, except if you really, really have to. And then the other way that's interesting with water is that in many areas, maybe not this year, but like when I was living in California, we were under drought a lot of the time. Your dye baths can be saved, and you can use the exhausted water for quite some time. And so you can really conserve water with natural dyes if you live in a drought area. I keep drinking tea. That's what you're hearing, because I have a little tickle in my throat. And I think it's because I haven't done a podcast. I don't know. It's been like 3 months. I'm not used to talking this much. Not since I've been teaching have I talked this much. So here are the benefits of natural dyeing. So the biggest benefit is just to get away from that toxic petroleum-based dyes that are used in fast fashion, that, you know, are those, you know, bright neon colors that are toxic, not only as they are being applied to the cloth, but actually as you are wearing them too. For more information on those kind of things, listen to last season's podcast, because that's all about fast fashion and the fiber shed movement. And I talk a lot about some of the toxicities that happen within the dyes and the textile manufacturing. And the other benefit is when we use dyes that we have grown ourselves or we have foraged, then we're in conversation and we're in communion with our local landscape. It's like a dance between the earth and the water and the sun and the dyer in order to express the color on textiles, whether that be yarn or roving or actual cloth. And as I said before, it's an art to coax the color out onto the cloth, the yarn, or the fiber. And each day is going to be a little bit, it could be a little bit different. And getting to a place where you as the dyer become so practiced that you can coax that pot to get it just to the right color that you want. And that's what's fun about really learning about natural dyeing. Now, yeah, there's some drawbacks. The biggest drawbacks of natural dyeing is going to be that some of the dye stuffs are not color fast and they're not light fast. And that means over time that they will change, that some of them will lighten. Some of them may even darken. There's a couple that actually darken with UV exposure. And others will become grayed or browned out. And it just is the nature of natural dyeing. And I firmly believe that here is another opportunity to become in conversation with our naturally dyed textiles. It's another place where we could change our mindset. You know, just as we all change over the years, our clothing and our home textiles are no different. And the change really should be celebrated. It's okay if that, you know, that once pretty blue pair of jeans that you got, you know, after you've been wearing them year after year, they get lighter and lighter and lighter. You know that. You already own jeans. And you don't immediately say, oh, they've gotten lighter, I'm going to throw them out. No, you still love them until they finally wear out, or you patch them or mend them or whatever. And you really can overdye at some point too, to create a whole new color on that really loved piece of clothing. Another drawback of natural dyeing is that it takes time. It takes thought. You know, if you're going to use cultivated dyes, you got to plant the seeds. You got to weed the garden. You have to go out and forage, or you have to go pluck the flower heads off of your magnolias. You need to prepare the textile, and then and only then can you apply the color. And it is within that slowing down that we also really develop the appreciation of the color itself and the appreciation of our textiles. It's so different from the commercial dyes that I use for the other half of my yarn, where that is more like cooking and more like science, where I know I add a little bit of this and a little bit of that in an exact proportion. I add my yarn, I cook it for 20 minutes or 30 minutes, and I rinse it out and it's done. I mean, that is boom, 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 and I have, you know, a finished product. Whereas with natural dyeing, it's going to be, I'm going to pick, and then I have to soak and develop this dye broth or dye tea that I'm going to work with. And then I have to leave it for a certain amount of time, and I have to coax it, and I have to look at it. And, you know, it's a very, very different process. It takes time, which can be lovely, but it just, you have to go into it knowing, oh, this is going to take a little bit more time. And because it does take time, it's really important to care for your naturally dyed textiles. And so the way that you can slow down some of the fading that you might get is, number one, to store it away from light sources. I know that, like, my closet has a window in it, and I keep looking at it thinking, it's a small window, but it's a window nonetheless. And I keep thinking, you know, maybe I should put something over that window just so that UV light doesn't come in, which is, for me, it would be like a couple of hours in the afternoon. But anyway, storing away from light sources is going to help, because you won't have that degradation with the UV light. Then washing mindfully, and again, I talked about this a lot in the last season, use cold water, please. Not only is it better for the environment, it's better for your clothes. Wash infrequently. I think we don't need to wash every time we wear our clothes. And then if you're going to use a dryer, put it on a low setting. Don't use high heat. Or if you are going to put them outside, make sure it's a breezy day so it's fast and that your clothes aren't out in the light too much. That one is a little like, don't put it in the light, but you can, then how do you dry it in the sunshine? So that one you have to kind of weigh what's happening outside. And number three is to avoid antiperspirants, especially those with aluminum. And that's for all of your clothes. Those are the ones that really stain your clothing. You know, if you ever go thrifting, those are the ones where, you know, the people that have the antiperspirants on, you know, they have like, you know, brown stains under the arms, and that's not good. So try to avoid using that. And again, like I said just a few minutes ago, you can always over dye your textiles when they faded, or to the extent where you're bugged by it. It's like, I can't wear this one more time. I just need to over dye it. So over dye it. So are you interested in dyeing and how to get started? Well, there's a really great resource out there called the Natural Dyers Journal. It's on the Chesapeake Fiber Shed website. And so it's available to everyone. If you are in the Washington, Delmarva area, if you're local to me, then a lot of the plants that we have researched actually do grow in our area. But many of them are grown nationwide, so you don't really have to worry about that. There are a ton of books out there, and I do have a free resource on my website that you can print out. And if you want to take a class, just send me an email. Tell me you're interested in a natural dye day. I'll be setting one of those up later in the summer or early fall so that you can have the experience of natural dyeing if you're local to me. If you're not local to me and you're still interested in a class, send me that email too, because then I can always do an e-class for people if there are enough people that want that. So, here's my dye highlight. It is cochineal. Cochineal is one of my favorite dyes. And it's one of the ones that It is an animal. So it comes from a very small female beetle that grows on Nepalis or cactus leaves. It used to be a dye that was foraged, but now it's being cultivated, especially in Central America, a lot in Mexico and in other countries down there as well. So the farmers, quote unquote, plant these beetles onto the cactus leaves, and they allow them to grow and prosper. And then they are harvested, and the cochineal gives us colors that range from like a true red and pink all the way to a magenta and lavender. It is very, very versatile. This dye is used in cosmetics, in your lipstick, anything that's like a red or pink. It's used in food as well, especially after we got rid of red dye number whatever it was back in the 70s. Now they use cochineal. Unless you are, and so of course many things will say that, you know, they aren't vegan, right? Because they're made from beetles. But they're used in so many products that we have. And this dye is very pH sensitive, so the color can shift based on whether you have an acidic water or an alkaline water, and you can use that to your benefit. I know that if I want to get more of a true red, that I need to add more vinegar to my water, and then I can play with it that way. It is really a fun dye. And here's my farm yarn highlight for this episode. And this is my Lively and Tresna. And these are our flagship farm yarns. They're the first ones that I ever made once I got my Cormo sheep. They are next to the Skin Soft. They make great anything, you know, shawls, sweaters, hats, gloves, the whole gamut. Anything that you want to wear next to the skin, it is great for. Lively itself is 100% Cormo. The way it was named is our first two Cormos were Viola and Lively, and so I squished their names together and came up with Lively. And then it's a 2-ply worsted weight yarn. It has more of a matte finish because the having very, very fine wool makes more of a matte look. So Tresna was and is made out of wool that comes from our crossed sheep. They're BFL, Blueface Luster, crossed with my Cormos. So it has a little bit longer staple length. It's more lustrous, so it's going to look more shiny. It's also a 2-ply, but it spins a little bit thinner. So it's going to be more of a DK, tending towards a heavy DK. And lately, because we've been downsizing our herd, these two wools now are going to be combined into one new Lively, probably call it something so fascinating like Lively 2, where they're both going to be combined into one yarn. And again, it will probably become either a heavy DK or light worsted, somewhere in that range, 2-ply yarn. It's from our farm to your needles. And until next time, happy making.
Well, that's this episode of the Flying Goat Farm podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider leaving a review. Have a question you'd like me to answer? Send an email to goatherd@flyinggoatfarm.com. And to see our farm and yarn and roving, check out our website at flyinggoatfarm.com. Follow me at Flying Goat Farm on Facebook and Instagram, and I'm Goat Herd on Ravelry. Until next time, happy making.